Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, American POW MIA's podcast, the voice of the missing in action and those that are buried as unknowns in our national cemetery. I'm your host and lead researcher, John Bear.
Just a boy turning 17, took me away from my home in Abilene. I was sworn I'm a soldier now, I was trained to survive. And from a boy I became a man, we journeyed to a place called Nam. Spent 13 months of living in fear. They say it's over, but I'm still here. Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me? Hey America, can you hear me? Why don't you set me free? Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me? Hey America, can you hear me? Why don't you set me free? Why don't you set me free?
Hey, everybody. Great to see everyone. I got a special guest today that I'll bring up here in just a few minutes. But today we're going to kind of discuss the Vietnam War POWMIAs and the mission, the accounting mission that goes into recovering those that were left behind. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a brief background on the agencies that are involved in this endeavor. The first is the primary agency is the Defense POWMIA Accounting Agency. And since 1973, the remains of more than 1,000 Americans killed during the Vietnam War have been identified and returned to their families for burial with full military honors. Of the nearly 16,000 Americans still accounted for from the Vietnam War, hundreds are believed to be non-recoverable category, meaning after rigorous investigations, the DPAA has determined that the individual perished but does not believe it is possible to recover the remains. On rare occasions, new leads can bring back the case back to active status. The DPAA and their partners continue to build on nearly three decades of joint field activities with the governments of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Each year, the DPAA plans multiple investigations in each country to collect evidence, investigate leads, and conduct excavations. The next primary agency that's involved in the Vietnam recoveries in Southeast Asia is the Defense Intelligence Agency. As the United States began investigating more personnel and resources to Vietnam in 1966, it was clear that a coordinated effort was needed to identify the status of prisoners of war, identify their location to support potential rescue operations, and to ensure that the U.S. bombing missions did not inadvertently hit POW compounds. In 1967, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or the DIA, took charge of this mission. Following the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Vietnam in 1975, a large number of live sighting reports and concern that U.S. soldiers were still being held in Vietnam and bordering countries led to a shift in DIA's mission. In 1986, DIA established the Stony Beach program to help resolve these cases. The Stony Beach mission is to achieve the fullest possible accounting for unaccounted for Americans from the Vietnam War. Today, Stony Beach is the only U.S. government entity focused solely on the Vietnam War POW/MIA accounting. I'm going to show a real quick video to y'all. I didn't have it prepped beforehand, sorry. And this is a little bit more about Stony Beach and the DIA's mission.
At the Defense Intelligence Agency, we never forget. We bring them home. The POWMI Recognition Day, which is the third Friday of every September, is a day that we take time to be able to recognize those individuals who have gone overseas and become prisoners or remain missing to this day, and to also think about their families. The Defense Intelligence Agency has led the POWMIA mission for the U.S. military for more than five decades, beginning in 1967. In the Vietnam War, the Defense Intelligence Agency began without having any formal role or mission with POWMIA. However, as more and more pilots began getting shot down, and as we put boots on the ground, it became clear that there needed to be a central organization within the Department of Defense to oversee the mission.
There were approximately 2,200 missing in action prisoner of war cases after the Vietnam War. These are our brothers and sisters, and we need to do everything that we can to account for them. One of the early successes was in 93. There was an Air Force pilot who was one of our priority discrepancy cases. And when we went to the location where we had determined through a number of investigations where he was likely to be, we found him buried in a makeshift coffin, intact flight suit, ID card, dog tags, and to be able to do that for a family was hugely important.
One of the five sections in the Defense Intelligence Agency Museum is called Bringing Them Home. PFC Jessica Lynch was a military member in one of the first units going into Iraq in 2003. Caught in an ambush, she was wounded significantly in a crash. And the Iraqis, after capturing her, took her to the Saddam Hussein Hospital in Baghdad. DI's efforts to obtain information on her status began immediately. We got floor plans for the hospital, and we also worked with collectors on the ground to be able to infiltrate an Iraqi citizen into the hospital with a camera hidden in a bag to be able to get proof of life on her status. Many people may not appreciate the fact that DI supports not only the POWMIA mission for military personnel, but also for American citizens and our allies as well, such as in the case of Jessica Buchanan.
I was working in northern Somalia as an aid worker. I had been tasked with going to check on educational staff in our southern Somalia office in October of 2011. We were on our way back to our guest house in the middle of the afternoon, and then we were taken hostage at gunpoint by many very angry Somali men. My one and only thought was that I wasn't going to get out of this thing alive until somebody started shaking my arms and legs and pulled a blanket away from my face and then identified themselves as basically SEAL Team 6.
We believed that there was a real chance that she could die while in the hands of her kidnappers. DI provided analytic support to those locations where we believe that she may be held. And upon providing that intelligence, a special forces operation was conducted to secure her.
It blows my mind, the level and the number of people that were involved in working on my case to get me out. It's incredibly humbling.
Right now, DI is still working on more than 1,500 cases, and we will do so until all of these cases are closed and dedicate the necessary resources across the world wherever we think that there's an ability to obtain information or update the statuses of these individuals to secure their release or to be able to bring them home.
The last agency I want to talk about, it's actually a nonprofit group, is the League of Families, which was started back during the Vietnam War by the wives of some of those POWMIAs that were shot down over Vietnam and Laos. They got their latest update for March 9th, 2021, on the status of those that are missing in action in Vietnam. Is due to the pandemic restrictions, the DPAA field operations were suspended in early March 2020 and are now just resuming. supported by DIA Stony Beach Vietnam Specialists. DIA Stony Beach Specialists are conducting field investigations in Laos and Cambodia, and Vietnamese officials are unilaterally conducting field recoveries in northern Vietnam. Currently, we're at 1,584 Americans that are still listed by the DOD as missing and unaccounted for from the Vietnam War, 285 in the country of Laos, and 48 in the country of Cambodia. The People's Republic of China territorial waters, there are 7 still unaccounted for there. These numbers fluctuate due to investigations resulting in changed locations of loss. The League of Families seeks the fullest possible accounting for those still missing and repatriation for all recoverable remains. Highest priority is accounting for Americans last known alive. U.S. intelligence indicates some Americans known to be in captivity in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia were not returned at the end of the war. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, it must be assumed that these Americans could still be alive, and the U.S. government should not rule out that possibility. I'm going to introduce our guest. Joining me today is U.S. Navy Senior Chief SEAL, retired Derek Van Orden. Derek is a former senior enlisted advisor, Operations J3, senior enlisted and compartmented operations planner for the Special Operations Command Europe. Derek served over 26 years on active duty with multiple combat deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan. He is also the best-selling author of The Book of Man, A Navy SEAL's Guide to the Lost Art of Manhood, and has appeared on national television as a subject matter expert. He is a sought-after speaker, owner of the Butternut Cafe, and Beat It Roach Creations Publication Company. Derek was also an actor in the 2012 hit SEAL movie Act of Valor, playing the badass role of Senior Chief Miller, who I would never want to be tracked down and interrogated by. During Derek's military career, he had the opportunity to support Joint Task Force Full Accounting in Vietnam. He is joining me today to talk about his experience on the Joint Task Force Full Accounting and what goes into these recovery missions and what it means to these men and women who help bring our MIAs home.
Right here?
Yes.
You think this is some kind of game? Do you find this amusing?
Hey, Derek.
How are you doing?
Doing good, sir. I sure hate to be sitting across the table from you.
So would I.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Let's kind of dive into a little bit of your, I guess we'll just start off with giving us some of your background in joining the Navy and start from there.
Sure. I joined the Navy in 1988 to get out of town, worked on a tugboat for a while, painted a lot of stuff, cleaned a lot of toilets. I found out about being a corpsman, which is a medic. Went there, and that's where I found out about the SEAL teams. So I went to SEAL training in 1991. Started with class 184, graduated with the same class, which was great. And then started my journey into SOF. Because I was a corpsman, immediately following Buds, I went to what was called the 300 F1 program in San Antonio, Texas. That is the 18 Delta short course in San Antonio. I went to SEAL Team 4 for 5 years after that, did 3 deployments, my first combat deployment to Bosnia, of all places. And then finished the Army Special Forces Medical Sergeant's course following that and became a fully qualified 18 Delta. And in the Navy, that gave me the Naval Enlisted Code as a Special Operations Independent Duty Corps. I transferred to SEAL Team 1, and that's when I found out about this opportunity to go do something called Joint Task Force Full Accounting, which was to find POW and MIA remains. And, you know, as a kid, I grew up looking at the Vietnam War. One of my earliest memories was in 1975. I was born in 1969. So in 1975, I was 6 years old. And I remember the evacuation off the top of the United States Embassy with those Huey helicopters. It's one of my earliest memories, watching that on a black and white television. And so that was the war that I grew up, it was closest to me growing up, and I always found it fascinating. I had 4 or 5 uncles that served in the Vietnam War, a couple in the Korean War and others in World War II. But so I always had an interest in Vietnam, the conflict itself, and I asked if I could go on this mission. They were taking Special Operations Independent Duty Corpsmen and then communications experts from both the SEAL teams, the Green Berets, and also they took comm guys from the Air Force. They stopped taking medics for a little bit. But so I signed up for it. This was in 1998. I was in initially an IE. That mission for JTFFA is split up into 2 parts. One is an IE, that's an investigative element, and the second one is a research element. The investigative element will pick up from where you mentioned the DIA starts doing initial intelligence gathering. So you have at least a roadmap of where you want to start out. You go to this village, talk to this person about this potential air platform that was shot down, crashed, or missing soldiers that are on the ground, Marines, or sailors that are on the ground. And so we flew into Da Nang, which was a very large Marine Corps base at the time. That's China Beach and all that stuff. So we flew into there and then wound up driving all the way to Hanoi, stopping at various places and forward basing out of a city called Vinh, V-I-H-N, for a lot of the time. For many of the little missions that we ran from there were, home based out of Vinh, which was at that time in North Vietnam. Now clearly it's a single country. But so that was terribly interesting, going and interviewing people that witnessed these aircraft being shot down. There was a couple of UH-1 Hueys, Navy birds that were shot down. F-4 Phantoms were a big thing. And then you would go out to these places, walk out there and look and see if you could find artifact, meaning cockpit glass, other parts of the aircraft itself. And if you could find enough artifact, and you could recommend this site for excavation. And that's where further on down the road, a RE, the research element, would come into play. And that's like straight up and down National Geographic, archaeologists, the grid patterns, the whole thing, the little trowels and whatnot, and getting dirt and shaking it up and all that. Well, I was only supposed to do this, the investigative element, but there was a dig going on in a place called Cam Duc, which is up near the Laotian border. I think it was 1 or 2 Air Force folks got the Medal of Honor. during this big battle. It's KHMADUC, Kamduk. Anyone can get on Google and look at it, it'll pop right up. Fascinating battle took place. There's 19 missing Marines in this single location. Yeah, and I'm envisioning this saying, well, there's 19 missing of my Marine Corps brothers here. This must be a huge area, but it was like 50 meters by 50 meters. But so they needed, on that dig that was taking place the first month that we were there when I was doing my RE thing, or IE, driving around interviewing people, there was so much unexpended ordnance, UXO on that site, they needed to have a physician or an independent duty corpsman to go to that site. So the day before I was coming home, I was gone for a month. I was told that I'd be going up there and sitting on this site for the research element in Kamduk because the naval doctor, naval officer, physician wanted to go home. So she went home. I took her spot and stayed there for another month. And it was truly fascinating. There's a sergeant major and a captain or something from the Australian 5th Special Forces group. And there was an issue with the mocking yards that were guarding the camp. They turned down the Marines. It just turned into this horrific, horrific battle. But what I found during that time was, further into the structure. So there are people, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, that this is what they do as a full-time part of their duty. The mortuary affairs folks are out of Sohai in Hawaii, and then the command element is out of Camp Smith. And what was, this is truly interesting to me. So I come from the SEAL teams and I go there, and this command, there's nothing classified. Zero. They don't even have burn bags in that command. And the reason being is there's so many of these conspiracy theories, which I think some of them could be accurate, about how our veterans, you know, our service members were blown off because they wanted to close out this chapter of the Vietnam War. And there very well may have been American servicemen left alive in that country after the war. I believe that. So one of the things they did to try to nip that in the bud with people saying you're having secrets is that they don't even allow burn bags. You can't do anything classified. So I can tell you anything that took place with that mission at all in totality, which I think is great in this particular instance. So they've got the professional folks and then they have the augmentees, the communications folks and the medical people. Then we roll in. And it was just, it was two incredibly interesting months. I mean, we almost got killed once there, which is, you know, kind of par for the course. Or we had to go find this F4, where's my camera? We had to go find this F4 that was way out in the jungle. So it was probably, like 8 clicks out from the LZ. We had to hump out there and then look around and come back. Well, they had cut the, cleared the top of this COSP off, you know, kind of this one of those little pointy mountains, you know, and we're going to land this MI-8 Soviet air helicopter, Vietnam Airlines. I have the barf bag from there. I can't go back to Vietnam because I stole it from the helicopter. It's like Vietnam Airlines barf bag. I'm like, this is awesome. So we were going to come in to land. And if you think that there's this big cost and then it drops down into this riverbed, and then probably 1.5 or 2 kilometers across the way, there's this big marble mountain, mountain face. So we're going to come in to land and, you know, I'm a SEAL, right? So I do this all the time. So we're about to hit the deck. I undo my seatbelt. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden this bird, it kicks up in the air and then turns upside down and flies upside down into that river valley. Then it rights itself. And then we almost smash into this cliff, the big mountain face, flip around, and then we land. And I'm like, bang, 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 pinball this thing.
You tell me you didn't go there for an air show?
I look like an idiot. Let's just be honest. So we land, and I'm like, what was that all about? Well, the crew chief was looking outside the side where they have a right side door on these Soviet helicopters. And as we were coming down, he realized that when they cleared that area off the top of the COSP, they left this little teeny fence on there. And we're about to clip that fence with the rear rotor blade of that helicopter. And if you take off that rotor blade, you're done. You would have flown right off out of that. So when we landed out and I found that out, I'm like, wow, this pilot was absolutely amazing. He turned that helicopter upside down, flew it upside down into the river, and then almost smashed it, flipped around, led. And then we're like, okay, that's good. Thanks for that.
That's crazy.
Oh, it was bananas, you know. And then we wound up, you know, hopping 8 clicks or back, and we did find a bunch of artifact, cupping glass and all this stuff, and then came back out. What was interesting is that you have to, there's only so much planning you can do. So I would do a very detailed terrain analysis, map study, make sure that we'd have the appropriate amount of the ability to communicate with people. You know, now that there's satellites that are geostationary everywhere. Back then, that was 98, you had to have a bearing in an azimuth. So you had to make sure that you'd have look angles, the appropriate stuff. And that, the comm guy does most of that stuff, but as the medic, you got to make sure that you're doing that. And I'd been a SEAL for 6 or 7 years, 8 years by that point. So, you know, I'm on task. But my medevac plan or my CASEVAC plan, if something were to happen along that route, we were roughly following a river that went way back, was because you couldn't get a vehicle in there and you couldn't land a helicopter because you have this, at that point, some of it was triple, but a lot of it was double canopy. So you have secondary forestry growth. I don't know if you're familiar with that stuff, but mm-hmm. just, yep. you know, so you cut stuff down. Yeah, you know, it's way worse because there's much more undergrowth. But my plan was, if I had a casualty, was to take my medical bag, which I have a waterproof, it's a dry suit bag essentially that we designed in the SEAL teams. You can buy them in the civilian market now, they're ludicrously expensive, but was to bandage up my patient and then float them down the river to get back to that spot where that river met the big river where we almost crashed, and they could pick us up with a helicopter.
So oh, wow.
Yeah, that was the whole plan. They're like, this is crazy. I'm like, okay, do you have another one? They're like, nope. Okay, well then it's no longer crazy, it's called practical.
Exactly.
But you know, thinking this, we didn't have any issues with that. But the dynamics between the teams and the villagers and the you know, the governmental officials, I thought was fascinating, in that I assumed that everyone would be very, very angry at us because yeah. you know, we bombed them for 15-18 years. I don't even know how long it was, it depends on when you do the start and stop dates. But there was one guy that apparently was in one of the villages he went to, that, you know, 6 members of his family were killed, and he was exceptionally angry, and the governmental people knew that he was going to be there, and they kind of shoot him off. But all in all, I found the Vietnamese people to be very accepting, very nice. The food is fantastic,
yeah.
and they were very helpful, which I appreciated. And it's a duty that we owe to the men and women, moms and dads, brothers, sisters, cousins, when our servicemen and women go overseas, we have to make sure that is a, when someone joins the military, that is, it's planned as a 30-year cycle. I don't know if you're aware of this. When someone joins the military, it's on a system, and they have a career planned out for that person as an enlisted person for 30 years, and they can get out and do whatever they want. But so that's just the duty period. If you're killed on active duty and your remains aren't recovered, that 30 years goes to 300 years. It's in perpetuity, where your nation is asking you to do things, and your nation writ large owes your family, owes that to them to try to help give you as much closure as possible. And for me personally, you know, I'm not tied to mortal remains, but so many people are. And for them, it's very, very important. So I think that having that mission and having that those dedicated group of folks that are willing to do that day in and day out, because that's just gut-wrenching, man. I really respect them a lot. Yeah. Okay. Whew, there you go. Long stories.
Well, that wasn't too bad. That wasn't too long at all. So what was it like at, you know, look, give me a little more about your interaction with the local people there. I know that the Vietnamese government has a person that goes into the village with you, and I think you guys have translators or whatever, and you actually go in and talk to
right. people. So you've got on the IE element, the investigative element, you've got we had a dude with us named Al. He was half Japanese. His mother is Japanese. His father is Caucasian. He looked Vietnamese. But he was a 3-3, so that means speak and writing 3-3 in the Defense Language Institute scale of language ability for Vietnamese. He's absolutely amazing. He was with us. We had some EOD guys, explosive ordnance disposal people, and then we've got mortuary affairs people, and then, you know, kind of staff people, and then team leader that's there. And what would happen is you drive up to a village, you'd have your leader with you. We had a guy named Colonel Coy initially, who worked with the American pilots in Hanoi. He told me that was his job description. I'm like, okay, great. You worked with the American pilots in Hanoi and you speak English. Great. So you're torturing Americans. That's what was taking place. You know, that was his job at the time. It just was. The American servicemen and women, the POWs, are treated horribly by the Vietnamese, and you can't get around that. They just were. It's different cultural norms and all that stuff. And we just got to put that aside. But so you go and you sit down. It depends on what the scenario would be, but you'd be at the village building, like that town hall, we call it here, and you have Americans of the government people on one side, and then the villagers, everybody on the other side, and you just go through and ask them questions, and you pull out a map. Most of them didn't understand how to read a map, but they know which paddy leads to which paddy dike, which goes to the next paddy, which goes to the next dike, to the creek, to the river, you know? And you kind of walk them through that, and you realize where you'd have to go, and then you just plot it out and kind of go out there. What I did, I did the first few series of those meetings, and then I realized that I wasn't truly value added in that particular scenario. So what I did is I brought a ton of extra medical stuff with me, and I would do mini med caps, these little, you know, my own medical things in the villages. So I'd be outside with the women in the village and the children in the village and some of the men, and passing out toothbrushes, showing how to use them in mouthwash and checking their temperatures, and just doing general care. I mean, the Army Special Forces Medical Service course is one of the finest medical courses you can go to anywhere at all. And a huge portion of that is tropical medicine. So you have just regular stuff. I live in Vietnam problems. You have helminthic or, you know, worm infections, and you've got bad teeth, and your ears are interesting that the Vietnamese have incredibly clean ears. I found it fascinating. When you go to get a haircut, which I don't need anymore. At the time I did, but part of your haircut, they would cut your hair, then they'd shave your entire face with a straight razor. I mean, like your whole face. And then they'd clean your ears with a curette. So yeah, it's a different thing. That's why I love traveling around, because that was just totally normal. You know, the barber's got one of those little lights and he's looking at your hair doing it. But so I didn't have to worry about their ears, but I'd look at them in and wait to see if they have any otitis media or anything, you know, middle ear infections. And that was a way to kind of bridge the gap between our two cultures. And that's what I found really interesting to do. And then I'd go out and help dig around and stuff. And then the REs, the research elements, you're really stationary in a single place. So we stayed in the same hotel, which, you know, it was not the Best Western. So they used 220 there. Here's something funny. They use 220, not 110. And everything is wet and it's damp all the time, just because, you know, you're in Southeast Asia. And so I was getting up in the morning and I was going to go take a shower, and I'm like trying to hit the light switch. Okay, so check this out. As opposed to like shunting wires when you move the switch, all they did is just cut the wires. So you got two hot wires and they're just a little past flush with the tile. So I'm standing in a puddle of water. Wow. Did not need a cup of coffee that morning.
Yeah, I bet that woke you up pretty quick.
Yeah. But, you know, things, the relationships between the villagers and the governmental officials are what you made of them, just like anything else in life. I would be very open with them and help them as much as we possibly can. We did the first annual Cam Duk Friendship Games when I was there. It's kind of fun. It's like a mini Olympic thing. So the Cubans came in as part of their exporting of the revolution, and they built all these hospitals and these stadiums. So you go, wow, there's this huge hospital. You walk in there, there's nothing in there. Nothing. You know, like maybe a couple ratty beds, there's no equipment. You go into these stadiums, they look sort of okay from the outside, but there's dilapidated on the inside. And it was really an allegory to socialism. And that was really, really powerful. That was the second or third socialist country that I worked in. And I mean, on a quasi-political note, We just need to be very careful not to get involved in that here in this country. And I'll leave it there because this is not a political thing, and it can never become a political thing at all. But
couldn't agree more.
Oh no, just forget about it. So just seeing though how that worked, how that unfolded. And it was funny, this guy named Colonel Coy, my favorite. I'd sit and eat quail eggs with him at night, which, you know, they're like that big, dude.
Right.
And so you gotta eat a lot of them. But so we'd eat quail eggs and then drink this stuff called Cup Loi, which is Vietnamese rice whiskey. And so I would just sit and we would talk because he could speak English and learn more about his perspective of the war and, you know, why they did what they did and why they thought that they were justified in what they're doing. And it was terribly interesting. But this guy, so we had these camped up friendship games, right? Because the relationships between the Americans and the Vietnamese had gotten a little tight during that month because it's very stressful. And you're working with, sorry, I'm going to plug my phone here. You're working with the local folks also, and the relationships were kind of strained. And so I came up with this idea to do this friendship game thing. Let's stop what we're doing. Let's take a full day off. We got a pig, we did a roast and hung out. But this guy, whichever team was winning at whatever point, he would go over to that team. And like, I'm like, hey man, no,
he just wanted to be the winner.
Right, you're on one team, just one. But yeah, it turned out very, very, it was a rewarding experience for me personally, but professionally, it was rewarding too, because, you know, you're out there and you got to do it. But then as an American, more importantly, you know, we should be doing things for America, not personal, professional growth. If at some point you have to, but you have to look at the grand scheme of things. Why do we really do things? We found a couple teeth and a lot of other artifact at that site in Camp Duk. And so as an American, it made me think, you know, this is time well spent. I've been away from my family for 2 more months in a row, but there's somebody, and I'll never know who it is, you know. I guess I could look up and try to find out, but I will never know who that helped and let some kid now that's my age understand where their dad was killed or and give them a sense of peace.
Yeah, give them that
closure. That's some pretty cool stuff, man.
Yeah, that is. That is. And, doing some background research, especially into the Vietnam War, the SEAL teams really got their start. Well, they got their start in World War II and stuff like that. But they really started running their missions there in the Vietnam War. And I was kind of looking into it, and there are no MIAs that are SEAL team MIA members from the Vietnam War. And I found that pretty fascinating that none of your teammates were left behind there. If you compare it to like MACV SOG and those, I think there's still 50 MACV SOG members that are still MIA. But
well, just to be clear, there are no missing SEALs.
Correct. Yep. I just found it really interesting that there weren't from the Vietnam.
So World War II, we started as NCDUs, Naval Combat Demolition Units, that evolved into UDTs. In 1962, the SEAL teams and the Green Berets were made. That was John F. Kennedy's "Don't ask what you can do for your country." At the end of that, he's like, "Oh, we're going to have a bunch of crazy monkeys with good-looking hair." I think that's probably a direct quote from Kennedy, from SEALs.
Right.
Yeah, and great dancers, huge part of the program. No, there just aren't. There are not. And when you say MACV SOG, that's Military Assistance Command Vietnam, and there's a tremendous amount of Navy SEALs that were there also.
Correct.
We have always been a smaller unit or smaller units, and we had some issues. You know, Mark Luttrell went missing for a while. Neil Roberts, who's a friend of mine, he's the first American service member killed in Afghanistan. You know, he was on the ground by himself for a while, but we get our own back, and whoever has done anything that to a Navy SEAL will pay hell
Yes, they will.
Right. And it should be the same for every service member. That should be the same for, I don't want to say that, you know, we're these altered NATO torpedo folks, we're trained to a much higher level. And there's something incredibly special about Special Operations Forces. There is, that's why special's in the name. But I'm telling you, you're an Air Force female E3 working in the chow hall and someone abducts you, you get missing. I want the entire full force of the United States military and the whole of government approach to go find you and crush anybody that had anything to do with harming you or kidnapping you. So any member of the United States military or any American citizen who is abducted or detained or anybody by a hostile body, that body needs to know that we will never rest until you are buried in the ground. And you can tell Osama bin Laden that. He thought he got away with that stuff. So guess what? Rob O'Neill's a friend of mine. No. Yep. You mess around with America, you're never going to have a good night's sleep again, ever. Don't ever forget that. If any of your guys are jihadis are watching this, we will come find you. I don't care where it is or how old you are.
Like I said,
about that, man.
Yeah, like I said, I wouldn't want to be sitting on the other side of the table from you and being interrogated. Yep.
Well, we just need to look at things for what they are. You do fight a war, there's going to be things, there's going to be people that you just simply can't find. I mean, bombs, you get atomized, you know, you can't find some of the remains because there's nothing there to be found. And that's just the way war is. It's terrible. You know, you shoot somebody down in World War II over the middle of the Pacific, you're not going to find that person, that the remains, you're just not going to. And I guess you're in the middle of Papua New Guinea. I mean, you sit down a hamburger, it's rotten in an hour and a half, and it seems like a horrible analogy, but it's not. We are, you know, we're flesh and blood, and that's the way it works. But that doesn't mean that we should not do our absolute best at all times to make sure that we can fulfill the commitment that the government makes to an individual American citizen when they make a commitment to the government. That's a two-way street.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think what are your thoughts? Do you think our government should be doing more for the POWMIA issue? I think they have a mandate now, the DPAA has a mandate now of accounting for 200 service members a year. Right now there's 38,000 that can be identified and brought home from World War II, a few thousand from the Korean War and a few hundred from the Vietnam War. Do you think that the government 200 is enough a year?
I think that's a lot. When you look at, oh, it's 200, you should do more because there's 40,000. All right. To get one of those persons back to positively identify the remains, it's not just, oh, I think I'll go to Cambodia today, or I believe I'll go over to, you know, Papua New Guinea, I'm going to head over to North Africa. There's the logistics that are behind that, the information gathering and trying to narrow that stuff down, the actual research that it takes to find that one person it's voluminous what you come out with. So you look at this and say, we should be able to do 1,000 a year. I don't even know what that would cost. Not that you want to put a monetary attachment to somebody's remains, but just the ability to recruit the people to do that, to have the full-time staff, the physical and communications infrastructure that it would take to do that. I think really it's not insurmountable, but there are so many things going on in the world right now. I mean, the goal of the United States government should be to make sure that we don't have any more MIAs. Correct. And how you do that is you posture yourself very strongly so you don't have to get involved in these conflicts anymore that we've been in since, you know, forever now. That should be the primary focus, is not making any more MIAs. And a secondary focus could be recovering the ones that we can't find right now, giving peace to their families. But that's people just, you know, it seems like 200 is nothing, but to find even a single set of remains, positively identify them, and then return those, repatriate them back to the United States is a huge effort for one. 200 is a lot.
Yeah, I think it's rough. It's costing, I think they're, it's right around $800,000 per identification is what it's.
That would totally make sense to me.
So yeah, it's my only gripe, I guess, is I wish that they'd do more partnering with non-governmental organizations that they can help, that have these DNA labs and different things like that, so they can process more of these remains, especially the remains of those that are buried as unknowns in our own cemeteries from World War II. And, that's where the majority of Mars are. They're in our own cemetery.
Not to, get off on a political hoo-ha here, but I have been underwhelmed by the governmental response from the perspective of administrative cowardice. Yeah. So you have these people that are so risk averse that have never heard a shot fired in anger. They couldn't care less if there's a grieving widow over here. They're like, they'll shine around, shake her hand, pat her on the back, and then go sit around the water cooler and go, oh boy, what's her problem? They'll do that. Not these people. Let me be super clear. Not the folks that are involved in this joint task force full accounting. They're the level of professionalism on those folks was, I can't help you understand what I'm saying. Professionalism and dedication to the people assigned to joint task force full accounting. I can't say anymore. Just they're fantastic. But when you're getting into the deep-seated bureaucracy of the United States government, these become numbers. There's not a face attached to them. There's not a family attached to them. There's not the heartbreak that's attached to them. There's not the struggle that they went through even during their service. They're just a number. And they become this political, they become a little political pawn for them, which is abhorrent. So being able to, and this is in the previous administration, there was some outreach along the lines of faith-based service stuff to help with PTSD and veteran suicide, which is one of my things that I work on, is trying to prevent veteran suicide. Getting out there and saying, hey, does this work? Yeah, does it have to deal with the faith-based system by some, Harvard? This is what I learned in my college thing. It works. If it works, it works. If you could have a group of people in the United States government pair with NGOs that are interested in applying their resources that they are putting their money and their time and their equipment, if they're willing to put that forward, then we should be doing that. And if we're not doing that, it's because of administrative cowardice. And I have no room for that at all.
Yep. Agreed. 100%. I think now you're from Wisconsin. That's and, right. I think Wisconsin's taken a very good lead at the state level on the POWMIA issue. I know that the university there, Madison, they're partnering with the DPAA to go out and do some of these recovery missions and do the historical research, and then they get their archaeologists involved, their students, and they've got a contract with the DPAA to go out and do. I think they're going to be starting to work on some of these World War II European battlefield recoveries, and then the state has kind of stepped up to the plate, and they say they want to bring all their MIAs home, and they're actually providing funding, I think, to the MIA issue. So hopefully other states will follow and do the same thing.
Well, I'd like to see a little. A lot of people say a lot of stuff. A lot of people write fancy papers and we're doing this. I will reserve judgment until I start seeing some stainless steel coffins coming back with flags over.
Agreed.
That's all I'm going to say about that. I'm sick and tired of people saying, I'm going to do this, I'm doing that, I'm your best friend, I'm going to pat you on the back. And I want results. There's been so much talk about this stuff forever, going all the way back to when these wars were taking place. I mean, forever, not just World War II, we're talking World War I, the Spanish-American War. We go all the way back. So many people they're going to shine you on, man. I want results. I'm sick and tired of these bureaucrats running their mouth and, just saying the best things, and then 5 minutes later, they don't remember your name. So if if UW-Madison is going to do that, if the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs is going to do that, great. Show me the money. I don't want to hear them talk anymore. I don't want to hear them talk anymore. I don't want to hear any of these governmental agencies run their suck for another 5 minutes until I see results. Because you know why? The lady in Des Moines who doesn't know where her son is or her husband is, and the kid in Arkansas who doesn't know where their dad is, couldn't give a rat's you know what about someone saying they're going to do this. They want to know where they're at. Yeah. And it's within our capabilities as a government. We just did a $1.9 trillion bill for I don't know what. And we can't apply resources to finding our MIAs. No, I refute that. I don't accept that. I want to see action.
100%. 100%.
Okay. Hello, was I out?
No, I agree.
I go back to the senior chief. I'm like, I'm done with this, man. I'm done hearing all this hooey.
Yeah,
people's minds at rest or shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and I've been working researching cases from mainly I deal in World War II on the research stuff that I do. And you know, I've got one case that I just kind of solved the mystery of. It involved three army soldiers that were in the European campaign, and all three were killed on the same day. They identified all three of them originally by their dog tags, had them buried in the temporary cemetery. They disinterred one because the family wanted them sent home to North Carolina. So they disinterred those remains, sent them to North Carolina. And then another mother was writing the government saying, well, I want to return my son home to New York. And when they disinterred those remains, they determined that, he had two different sets of dog tags on and plus an identification bracelet. And so that's not who it really was. And they already notified the family that, you know, he was killed and they knew where he was. So they ended up somehow, an anthropologist, I think at the time, looked at these remains and said, oh no, it's the guy that we just sent to North Carolina. That's who we got here in Europe right now. So they take those remains, send them to North Carolina, swap them out. And then they take the remains from North Carolina and send them up to New York. And then they list the other guy as missing in action, the third guy. Well, actually, the guy that they sent to New York, an anthropologist looked at those remains after they disinterred them from the private plot. And the anthropologist told the Army, that's not who it is. Well, the Army didn't care. They just said, well, send him to New York and give him to the mother and bury him. And, it's two different people. They were co-mingled remains, from what I gather out of the paperwork. It's not who they say it is, but then the Army classified the files and they kept them classified up until 2015, 2016. And researchers are just now getting our hands on these individual deceased personnel files where we could kind of sort through them and try to put the pieces together. But so I just contacted the family here a few weeks ago, letting them know that the person that they thought that they had buried in the ground for the last 70 years is actually not who's there in that grave.
Yeah. Well, that's, so if you look at that, that's a great example of why this is so hard and why you can say we can only do 200 of these a year.
Yeah.
Because it's, you're looking 70, 80 years back, like World War One, 100 years back. One of my uncles was reported CIA in Europe, and my auntie sent me the newspaper clipping. Uh-huh. And then later on, they got a letter from a POW camp. He was captured during the Battle of the Bulge. They thought he's dead.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah.
And so I hope that if anybody is watching this who has a loved one that's missing, I do want you to know there is a dedicated cadre of people working on a JTFFA, and there's a group of the folks at the DIA that are really trying hard. But that doesn't mean you ever give up. You write your congressman, you write your representative, write the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, you write all these people and say, what in the hell are you doing? Yeah. And hold their feet to the fire. But there are groups of folks, and the work that you do, John, pro bono, is just, it's awesome. There's thousands and thousands of people that do this. It should be led. I'm not a big government guy. I'm not a big regulation guy. I'm not, you know, I don't want to create the bureaucracy for this. And, you know, you got to wear red tennis shoes or whatever the heck it is. You know, someone's going to watch all the time. I'm not that guy. But this is one of those things where I do believe that this is an absolute judicious expenditure of taxpayers' dollars, is to at least be the person that is corralling together all these thousands of Americans that are dedicating tens of thousands of their hours every year to try to, you know, close out a very difficult and painful chapter in people's lives.
Yeah. You know, these men and women gave their last full measure for the freedoms we enjoy, and it's the least we can do for them is to bring them home and put a name on their headstone. So
yeah,
that's
the right one. That's, you know, that's one of the horror stories when the stuff started, the JTFFA, they did exactly that. They, this is that scuttlebutt around the water cooler.
Right.
It's that they're like, Mrs. Jones, we found your son. You can, you know, rest and, you know, relax now. And she's like, actually, John lives in Cleveland and he's a mechanic. What? So when you find these remains, the processes that they go through to make sure that they don't make that mistake is detailed is an understatement. That's another reason why you can only do 200 of these a year, because it takes forever to make sure that they don't make that error again. Could you imagine that? That'd be heartbreaking.
Yeah, it would be. It is heartbreaking. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. My only heartburn in the whole deal is I wish we could do more. And just for the simple fact that, you know, when we're looking at the World War II losses, a lot of these men still have brothers and sisters that are still living, but they're in their 90s and they don't have too much longer to see their sibling come home. So
yeah.
That's why I do what I do and try to push as much as I can on the World War II identifications is to try to get these men home to their family while their family's still here.
Well, hey, let me ask you a question. I looked last night. I found two female MIAs, and I don't know if they're MIA.
Okay.
This is kind of this nebulous thing. Are there any female MIAs that you're aware of?
From what wars?
Just at all.
I'd have to research it.
Look into it. Interesting. I mean, Amelia Earhart was not in the service when she went missing.
Right.
Well, she wasn't.
No.
But I was trying. There was a couple females that I saw, but they're all recovered. Oh, and by the way, that hospital's in Nazaria that Jessica was rescued from. Yeah, not Baghdad.
Oh, is that all on the video? Yeah, yeah, the DIA video. I guess the Defense Intelligence Agency doesn't know their own.
I think they just threw that out there, but I've been to that hospital.
Yeah, yeah. Were you there on that one? Were you?
I was not.
Oh, okay.
I went there. Just, you know, you got to go talk to the people.
gotcha. Yeah, that's funny. The DIA would get that wrong.
Well,
yeah.
I'm sure they want. Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on and talking about your experience there in Vietnam and the supporting the POWMIA accounting mission. You know, that's.
Yeah. I tell you one thing though? So I.
Oh yeah, keep going.
We went in 1996. So we went there, and they're like, "Yeah, I went to Vietnam." And people are like, "I go 1996, not 1966. I know I look that old, but I'm not." And here's something else. If you're listening to this, I saw some Marine Corps punk on his official thing calling a news guy okay boomer. Did you see that thing?
I didn't.
You better get right before you get left, boomer.
Boomer
talking about a television host from an official Marine Corps thing. It was a big deal. They had to apologize. Guess who those boomers are, you little punk out there? Those are the people that we're talking about. Those are our Vietnam veterans that continued the glorious reputation of the United States Marine Corps in Vietnam through their sacrifice and service. Those are the boomers that you're talking about, Marine. Boy, that got me going, man. That dude had been working in the chow hall so fast. Yeah. His ex-colonel all the way down, sergeant majors and everybody down to whoever wrote that, they'd be flipping burgers for a good month in that chow hall. Ask me if you want fries with that. Acceptable.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you again, Jared.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate it. And I don't see if there's any questions in the chat there. So I don't see any there. Mel
yes.
And Nettie.
Yes, this Nettie's is my real hair.
Yeah. Nettie says yes, it was so great to meet you, Derek. So
well, anytime, just give me a holler, will you?
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And I'll, you know, if is there any place where you want anybody that's watching or gonna be listening to this in the audio form, where they could find you on, I know I follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, Derek Van Orden at Twitter, Derek Van Orden at Facebook. Yeah, I don't, hopefully you don't have enough time to actually watch the stuff that I'm writing, but keep up the good work, will you please? And anyone else that's listening, if you're out there doing this work, you're actually doing God's work. I believe that.
Amen.
So keep it up. You are helping people because you can help them, not because you have to. And that is truly admirable. So I wish you just the best night.
All right. Appreciate it. If you got a few minutes to stick around, I'll drop you back down and I'll put the closing on and we'll take it from here.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Again, thanks, Derek, for coming on and talking to us about his service. We're going to take the next few minutes to honor a fallen Vietnam hero who was recently accounted for. I want to recognize tonight Sergeant First Class Alan L. Boyer, who was born in Chicago on March 8, 1946, to Charles and Dorothy Boyer. Alan graduated from MacArthur High School in 1964 in Decatur, Illinois. While attending the University of Montana, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. He completed airborne and special forces training and volunteered for the Secret War and MACV-SOG. He was listed as missing in action on 28 March 1968 in Laos. His remains were repatriated and identified by DNA in March of 2016. The video you're about to see is the funeral service with his full military honors at the Arlington National Cemetery on 22 June 2016. He is survived by his sister, Judy Boyer Bouchard of Leesburg, Florida. Please stay to the end and help me honor Alan's service and sacrifice for our freedoms. And thank you again for watching Stories of Sacrifice. If you want, please consider supporting our mission and helping getting these heroes identified and brought home for an honorable burial. Again, I want to say thank you for everybody for watching.
Eagle soars above our land, flag so proudly hailed. Be proud of this America. Realize we failed to bring our missing men back home, prisoners of war. MIA's America, what are we waiting for? Bring them home, bring them home. Eagle flies in chains till we have them home again. Eagle flies in chains. That's not all. America, not only bullets kill, be sprayed with Agent Orange. I'm sick and dying still. Can't forget the combat vet. I wish this war away. His legacy, America, is living day to day. Bring them home, bring them home. The eagle flies in chains till we have them home again. The eagle flies in chains. War, it seems so long ago, but Uncle Sam forgets. War's not over for missing men, sick and dying vets. Bring them home, bring them home. Eagle flies in chains till we have them home again. Eagle flies in chains. Eagle flies. Change.